From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. Summer's here, it's getting hot, and your daylilies are blooming in the backyard. Or maybe not. Gardening mishaps happen to all of us, even if we think we have green thumbs. But we've assembled an expert panel of gardeners to discuss how to do it right in a backyard plot or a plant box in your apartment. This hour On Point, it's time to garden. You can join us on air or online. What questions do you have for our gardening experts? What are you growing? And what problems do you need to overcome? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Join me now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin is Melinda Myers. She's a gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist who's written more than 20 gardening books. She hosts the nationally syndicated Melinda's Garden Moment program, which airs on over 115 TV and radio stations throughout the U.S. Melinda, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
And with me from Birmingham, Alabama is Steve Bender, better known as the Grumpy Gardener. He's been a senior writer at Southern Living for more than 30 years, where he writes a gardening column called The Grumpy Gardener. You can link to it on our website, onpointradio.org. Steve, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you very much. Greetings and felicitations.
Steve, just a definitional point to begin with. People talk about gardening as a source of zen, joy, relaxation. So why are you grumpy?
Well, I guess the reason is because people will email me a lot of different kinds of gardening problems. And they want to know the solution, and a lot of times the solution is not that I give is not the one they were looking for. You know, they say, well, I live in Miami Beach and my lilac won't bloom. Why not? And I go, because you live in Miami Beach.
They don't want to hear it.
Don't grow down there. So, you know, I just try to tell them the truth, and sometimes that makes me sound a little disagreeable, but I'm trying to make them have success in the garden, and try to do more things.
Well, let me just say, as a political reporter, I feel you on that. Sometimes you say things that people don't want to hear. Melinda, I want to go with you on a question that we've gotten from our website that's one that I've wondered about.
Okay.
It's actually the two-part question. First, chipmunks in a fenced garden. Any suggestion for how to get them out and keep them out? And two, rabbits outside of the garden, but digging holes in my yard. The yard's too big to fence them out, but these empty holes are ankle breakers. Any non-lethal prevention methods?
I have to say, I have a deer fence around my garden where we do videotaping and photography, and the ground squirrels are having a great time inside. We trenched in 2 feet down and have hardware cloth 2 feet up, and one day I watched them climb up the hardware cloth, go through the deer fencing to get at the tomato. So I feel your pain. And I can talk big and tell you how to get rid of animals, but I won't kill them because I'm trying to coexist even though they're eating more than their fair share. So a couple things you can do. If you use repellents, trying to apply before they start doing damage. Obviously, a little late for this year, but if you use repellents, there are a lot of natural products out there and vary it a bit. Scare tactics don't work for a lot of us in urban areas because of the problem with they're used to us. Sound and noise and human smells don't work very well. The further you get away from the city or having neighbors further away, you might try some strong-scented soaps or human hair, cayenne pepper. It's a battle, and they have all day to figure it out. If you are fencing those small garden areas, what you might want to do is fence those prime garden areas, dig down 6 inches, and then bend the fencing away. So when those animals start digging, they hit that fencing and think they can't get through. And then always secure your gates. I had a woman that had damage. And I said, oh, it's rabbit damage. No, it's not. And so for a couple of weeks, we went back and forth and she called me and said, I do have rabbits. They're living inside the fenced area, nice and safe and close to food. So secure your gates as well. With rabbits filling the holes, if you know, the scare tactics, just keep after them, filling those holes to try to discourage them is probably the only lethal way. And live trapping, the problem is nobody wants that live, you know, that wildlife. And you can do more harm by taking a mom away from the babies or moving animals to an area they're not familiar. So there's no easy solution trying to be more persistent than the wildlife.
Steve, anything you either disagree with from Melinda or would like to add?
No, I think those are all good ideas. You know, it's a tough problem. My backyard, I have a woodland garden back there, and I have bunnies back there, and I've got chipmunks galore. I think while you can certainly try to exclude them through fencing and stuff like that, you also might think about what is it about your yard that attracts them in the first place? Because they got lots of other places they could go. For instance, if you go out into a national wilderness, into a forest where there's nobody around, you'll never see any squirrels. Why not? Because there's nobody feeding them. They love being around us. And if you go through a residential neighborhood with lots of squirrels, everybody's got bird feeders out there that the squirrels are climbing into. And they've got – so they've got food. And then they have bird baths, so they've got water. And then you have an attic, so they've got a nice, dry, comfortable place to spend the night. So I would say just look at it through their eyes. Why do they want to come into your garden? And if you got a bird feeder, you know, common sense is make it so that it excludes the squirrels. And so with only the birds are getting the food. Other than that, you can try repellent. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But you got to coexist with wildlife. It's out there. It's just a fact.
All right. We've got calls beginning to light up. Let's go straight to Bob, who's on the line from Melrose, Massachusetts. Bob, what's your gardening question?
Hi, John. My question is, I have a new septic system that was installed last fall, and we had to take down some trees, so I have full sunlight in a nice big area that's covered with sand and bark mulch. So I wanted to know what would be appropriate ornamental flowers or grasses to plant on that septic system that will grow, not hurt the system, and will grow in sand.
Is it a mound system?
It is.
Okay, so you need to be careful with drainage. Septics are always that great mystery. I have them where I live now, and right now we have grass. Using some of those ornamental grasses that are tolerant of sandy conditions might be an option for you, and then also some short grass prairie forbs. Usually the prairie grasses and forbs, the flowering plants, have deep root systems to help with water infiltration, but typically don't interfere with the mound. Steve, are you more of an expert at septics? It's always a great mystery, and there's not a lot of good information that's been updated out there.
Well, the problem is there's not a whole lot of really great solutions to that either, because you want to cover over that area, but you don't want whatever you plant there to get in where it's not supposed to be. So you're looking for something that's going to, you know, have foliage and stuff during the summertime, but you don't want deep roots. One plant I would suggest, if it's a sunny area, I would try a Galardia or a blanket flower, because that one will even grow in pure sand on the beach. It takes very little care. It blooms from spring to fall nonstop. It doesn't need to be fertilized, and it comes in lots of different colors and has a daisy-shaped flower. So that's one flower. It's a short-lived perennial, but it does reseed, and so you always have plants the next year. So that's one I would consider using.
All right, let's take a question from down south. We've got Emily on the line from Richmond, Virginia. Emily, go right ahead.
Hi, John. I am battling porcelain berries in my yard. They're beautiful, but they are taking over everything, and I am trying to dig up roots and cut them back, and I am not winning. So I'd love some ideas.
All right. Well, let's go to the guy from Southern Living to talk about this Richmond, Virginia problem. Steve, what
yes,
do you say?
Yes, porcelain berry. It's a very beautiful vine. It has people plant it because the berries on it are just can be blue or yellow. It's just gorgeous when it's in fruit. The problem is every one of those fruits falls to the ground, and then you get a million seedlings. And also porcelain berry, the vine itself, I call it kind of like the kudzu of the north. It will cover over trees. I think the best control, the easiest, if it's already going up a tree, I would cut the vine near the ground, and then I would paint the cut stem. I would treat it according to label directions with a herbicide, something like brush killer, which will be taken down to the roots. And so it'll kill the plant roots and all, and you won't have to worry about keeping pruning on that thing to keep it from taking over your entire yard.
Melinda, is there a category of problem that you hear at this point in the season about most often from your audience members in Milwaukee?
You bet. I think for any gardener anywhere, midsummer is a problem with insect and diseases. Many parts of the Midwest are getting extreme amount of rain. In fact, I was driving in, it was starting to sprinkle, and it's rained the last 2 days. So when we have a lot of rain, we have a lot of leaf spot diseases and root rots. When we get hot, dry weather, I know some of the portions of the Midwest are having a little bit hotter and drier weather, we see more aphids and mite problems. And so gardeners, I think one of the challenges besides wildlife that we've talked about is keeping plants healthy and alive. And one of the things I like to stress is the right plant for the right location, provide the proper care. We can't manage Mother Nature. But then if it's a healthy plant, it's going to tolerate that damage. And then looking for some eco-friendly solutions. You know, for aphids and mites, a strong blast of water knocks them down. If you need to step it up, do something like insecticidal soap that's a little gentler on those beneficial insects. And then wait to bring out the big guns if you really absolutely have to.
In the arc of a gardening season, where is this on the degree of difficulty, this particular point we're at?
Well, I think we're kind of inching up to the peak because we had such crazy extremes early in the season. Extreme cold and hot. We've had a lot of rain, drought in some areas. So I think we're starting to see those problems inch up. But gardeners are optimistic. We keep trying.
Excellent. Well, we're going to talk about some of those problems when we come back. We're getting the weeds out with our panel of gardening experts. You can join the conversation. Do you have an urban garden? Are you a plant person? Vegetables in your apartment? I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, and we're talking about all things gardening. You can join the conversation. Do you have a plot in a community garden? What do you like about growing in a communal space? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Melinda Myers. She's a columnist and contributing editor for Birds and Blooms magazine. And Steve Bender, author of Southern Living's Grumpy Gardener column and the 2017 book The Grumpy Gardener, An A to Z Guide from the Galaxy's Most Irritable Green Thumb. So grumpiness is Steve's calling card. At the risk of making him grumpy again, let's go to the phones. We've got a call from Jean in Collins, Vermont. Jean, welcome to the show.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Collins, Vermont. Okay. I have a question. Last night I was up in my garden, and I found little tiny holes in my pepper plants, pepper leaves, also the tomatoes, and it really surprised me, the potatoes. I think it might be flea beetles. That's my first question. I know I can use pyrethrins. Is there anything else organic I can use? It's a very small garden. Second question, I planted a couple of peach trees this year as an experiment. Red Haven's the variety, and I noticed one of them is being chewed at the top. I saw a little black beetle about a half inch long on the peach tree. Is there anything I can do about that? And thank you.
Steve, be nice to her.
Okay. I have no reason not to. I'm a friendly guy. I would suggest for both of those problems, a couple of natural insect controls. One is go out and look for something called neem oil, which is an extract made from a tropical tree that controls a whole lot of different kinds of insects, and it also controls some common diseases such as powdery mildew and black spot and things like that. There's another product that comes to us. It's a byproduct of the rum making process. It's called spinosad, and you can get this at a lot of garden centers. And again, this is a product that you can use in your garden. It's a natural product. It doesn't persist in the garden for a whole lot of time, but it does control a wide variety of insects that could get into your vegetable or fruit garden.
Let's go back to the phones, take another call. We've got May on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. May, you're on Point.
Hi, John. We have a two-part question regarding bamboo. We bought a home that has about 10 feet between us and the house behind us, and they put running bamboo up in between our properties, and it comes so close to our foundation line. I'm wondering, is it going to damage that foundation line? And also, we get so much rain in Nashville. Again, it's next to a concrete pad that tends to pool water. So is it actually helping to draw that water away, or is it contributing to the problem with the density of the rhizomes?
Thanks for that question, May. Melinda, what do you say?
Well, bamboo is one of those plants that I have to laugh. Rutgers University did an experiment in New Jersey to see if bamboo would survive, and they found out it did, and it did with a vengeance, that it was a road, a farmer's field, and some cement that kept it in check. They have now a bamboo grove, which is beautiful but a little intense. So back to your question. With bamboo, keeping it away from the house is probably a good idea. Their root system's pretty strong. I haven't really seen or heard of problems with bamboo pushing on the foundation. But you're right, that rhizome is so dense that it is helping to absorb some of the water. But just like if you've ever pulled quackgrass out of a garden, that soil's pretty dry. So it will help absorb. So it is doing some good, but you might want to manage it. And as you know, that's very challenging, especially when it's your neighbor's plant. You know, digging a ditch to kind of physically edge through and then manage it on your side if you want to keep it back from your house or away from the patio. And then consistently cutting it back, getting all of it, is that organic, non-chemical way of managing it. But if you cut it back and if you do decide to treat the sprouts, it'll take probably several applications. And be careful using something like a total vegetation killer, spot treat those problems, and it's going to take repeated applications to get it under control. You're probably going to want to manage it because it's only going to get bigger and spread more, and controlling it physically with an edge, a deep edge, and then also killing off those unwanted plants that are encroaching in those other garden areas.
Steve, I want to ask you one quick question about something I read the other day while preparing for the show. It may go against your grumpy image, but the question is, there was an assertion in a story that there are natural antidepressants in the soil, so that if you are gardening with your hands, that will have the effect of enhancing mood. Is that true?
I would like to say that I know that's true, but I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist.
Have you heard that? Is that talked about by gardeners?
I have heard of that. I haven't researched it enough to know whether it's true or not, but I just know that even if there aren't any specific compounds or chemicals there, the very act of getting out and gardening is an antidepressant. Just the action of getting out there and working with plants and being out in nature, that's all you have to do to get away from the concerns and pressures of the world.
Melinda?
Can I jump in? Yes,
please.
Exactly. So I'm the optimist over here, the counterpoint, I guess, to the grumpy gardener. Steve, you're a good buddy. So Steve and I know each other. But they have done a lot of research, and they did find a bacterium in the soil that they have used some of it as an airborne and some from what's in there. It's a Mycobacterium vaccae is the name of it. And they're finding it's non-addicting. They're doing further research to find out if it will treat OCD, bipolar. They think it may also have some benefit to things like Crohn's disease and rheumatoid arthritis. And Steve's right. Those of us that garden know we feel good when we garden. Now there's a lot of research backing what gardeners know to be true. And this is just one of those incidents. They've also done a lot of research and found that children who garden are more focused, score better in school. Girls that are raised in a landscape environment are more confident and suffer less from from peer pressure. And I meet a lot of families that are trying to help their young kids garden or grandparents teaching their kids to garden. And kids gardening is a great resource for people looking for educational information and activities to do with their kids or for teachers for their children. So, you know, starting us out young, a lot of us started gardening as kids, but even if you didn't, there's lots of value. And now the research is backing and even finding communities that have green spaces and community gardens that their overall health costs are going down. So there's a lot of research that's showing that gardening is good for the community as well as the individual.
Well, speaking of community gardens, I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Burlington, Vermont is Libby Weiland. She's the statewide network coordinator for the Vermont Community Garden Network, a nonprofit organization that connects community and school garden groups with resources across the state. Libby, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Libby, let me just ask you to begin by describing the breadth of this movement. I've got a couple of family members who have gotten involved in this movement. How widespread is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's been going on, since the early turn of the century, but it's really continues to pick up.
The turn of which century?
of the last century. Good question. But it continues to pick up, and you see it in urban areas. You see it in small towns, in rural environments, and schools, as Melinda mentioned, all over the place. It's really a lot of people are finding that opportunity to be a good way to get their hands in the dirt.
Would you associate this, Libby, with a kind of blue state phenomenon, or is this countrywide?
Good question. I would say it's countrywide. I think that gardening is something for everyone, and that's part of what's beautiful about it. Is it really extends crosses borders in terms of cultures and beliefs and interests and just that idea to be able to grow your own food is really universal.
All right. Well, let's bring a perspective from my children's generation, maybe Libby's generation, too. Felicity Duval is a millennial living in Omaha, Nebraska. She and her boyfriend have more than 120 houseplants, and she spoke to KMTV3 News in Omaha about the jungle-low they live in.
Air quality is better. They're very calming. They're fun to have around. I think they bring a good energy. Like, that sounds crazy, but like when you're sick and you sleep in that room, you feel better. And I feel better being around plants.
Libby, is the jungle-low something that's hot?
That's a good question. You know, it's something I actually haven't heard of, I have to be honest. But definitely that idea of surrounding yourself with plants and being surrounded by them, you know, makes a lot of sense.
Steve and Melinda, have you heard of the jungle-low movement or just the term?
I haven't heard the term, but I do know that many millennials are bringing houseplants indoors. A lot of people living in apartments or condos that may not have outdoor living space are finding exactly what that caller said, that there's wonderful air improvement. NASA did research and found that 18 small houseplants in an 1,800-square-foot house can greatly improve the air quality. And I also read somewhere that it's a great way to have something to take care of with minimal input needed. So you have that ability to raise and nurture something on a limited basis. Steve?
I would agree with everything you just said. I mean, as far as the air quality, there's definite research that plants like peace lily and spider plant and those sorts of things absorb contaminants in indoor air that come from wood finishes and upholstery and stuff like that. So it actually it's not a question anymore. It improves the air quality, and I think there's also
so maybe a few more plants, a little less Febreze.
But it also, I mean, I also think the activity of feeling like you're nurturing something inside is also a big benefit because again, it's a stress reducer. And when you have a favorite plant, it's almost like it becomes your kid. And you enjoy seeing it every day and seeing how it's changed and what you need to do.
Now let's go back to the phones. We've got Brooks on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Brooks, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. Thank you. I was just wondering if the guest could speak of the importance of planting native plants to promote insect diversity.
Melinda?
Yeah, native plants do a lot of good things. As you mentioned, they're the best best source of pollen and nectar and food for our insects, especially those beneficial insects. And we all need to remember that the majority of insects in our garden are good guys, and they help with pollination. They help manage bad insects. They do a lot of good things for us. And sometimes that's hard to remember when you see holes in the leaves of plants. They also have deep roots, which I mentioned earlier, and that helps with water infiltration, because one of the problems we're seeing across the country is we get a lot of water, maybe when we don't need all of that water. And so it often runs off into our stormwater system. And so by having native plants that have deep root systems, and when they die back over winter, add organic matter, that increases water infiltration, slows the flow of water so it doesn't run off into the storm sewers quickly. And so that's a really good option. The one thing I always like to mention is any plant you pick, native or cultivated, non-native, make sure it is suited to the growing conditions, because we've really destroyed a lot of our soil. Temperatures are a little different. So always pick the right plant for the location, and that goes with the native plants as well.
Libby Weiland, for those of our listeners who might not be familiar, could you describe a prototype community garden, how it works, how many people are involved, who does what?
Well, great question, but I would say that it's kind of all over the board. Depending on where you are and what kind of garden you're looking at, you know, community gardens can be involve hundreds of people. The concept generally, I would say the most typical concept is to have you actually rent a plot for the season, and they can be all different sizes, you know, kitchen gardens, smaller sizes to kind of larger
so you
plots.
Pay to be a part of the community garden?
Typically, yeah, mm-hmm. Typically is the idea, you know, usually a nominal fee, and then you have some responsibilities that you take care of your plot as well as some communal spaces, and you engage in some activities at the garden, that sort of thing, throughout the season. So that's probably the most typical, but they can look like all sorts of different things. We work with gardens that are more communal-based gardens, so that would be a large group of people that are all gardening the space together. And you kind of like a CSA, you get actually a share mm-hmm. of that garden after working a certain number of hours. They can be neighborhood gardens where just a group of families is gardening together. So,
but is the basic idea that people participate who may not have yards and garden space themselves, but they identify a shared space and they all do their part?
Absolutely. And, you know, I would say it's actually a little bit of both. So the primary idea is they don't have space elsewhere, so they use that space to grow their food. But I see lots of situations where people just, they have a little space in their backyard, but they either want to grow some really large crops, and so they want that space, they use the community garden for that, or they just want that opportunity to connect with other people in a shared growing space, to learn from other people, that kind of thing.
How many community gardens are in the network that you oversee in Vermont?
Yeah, so our estimate is about 500, and we call them community-based gardens here in Vermont, and so that includes that kind of prototypical thing I was just mentioning, that plot-based community garden that involves school gardens, which can involve community members in a lot of situations, that involves affordable housing communities that have gardens, workplace gardens, so lots of different people are finding themselves growing in community. But yeah, about 500 here in Vermont.
Steve Bender, do you see a lot of community gardens in Alabama?
Oh yeah, I think that this is a national thing. I see a lot of new planned communities, and one element that always seems to be there is they will have a community garden for people who don't have space in their own yards, but they can go out with their neighbors and get their own plot and try different things and compare notes. And one of the things I think is very, very important about this is if you look at the latest generations, the millennials and Gen Zs and stuff. These are, by and large, people who have grown up
and never been outside. You know, they spent all their days down in the parents' basement with the AC on and the video games.
Yeah.
And checking Instagram and their emails and Facebook and stuff like that. And so when they get outside, they don't know what to do out there. And this is a good way to get them involved and make gardeners out of the newest generation.
Steve, I'm going to say, if we've got a phenomenon that is popular in Vermont and also popular in Alabama, we have hit on something for sure that can bring the country together. We are discussing green thumbs and greenhouses. You can join the conversation. How has gardening affected your life? How has your garden evolved over the years? I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, and we're talking about the mind and body benefits of gardening. You can join the conversation. Has gardening helped your mental health? Given you solace at tough moments? Tell us your story. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Melinda Myers, TV and radio host, columnist, and author, who's written more than 20 gardening books, Steve Bender, senior writer at Southern Living, where he writes the Grumpy Gardener column, and Libby Weiland, statewide network coordinator for the Vermont Community Garden Network. I want to start with a question that we've just gotten from a viewer on Facebook. And the question is, as soon as I can find it, well, I can't find it. I'll find it in a moment. Oh, here it is. Jenny Anderson. She says, is there anything I can do to get rid of bittersweet? I'm currently just ripping it up and pulling it off the trees every season. Melinda?
Well, Steve had great advice for porcelain vine, and I think the same thing goes. Cutting it at ground level, then the top will dry up, and then treating the stump that remains. Always read and follow label directions, whether you're using natural or synthetic chemicals, because there's good advice on how to do it properly and not injure the environment and the surrounding plants. Invasive plants, the Asian version of bittersweet is not native and invasive. Both are American, and the Asian bittersweet, Oriental bittersweet, are very rampant plants. But the Oriental bittersweet is definitely listed as invasive in many states. So keeping it under control, cutting back, then you're not damaging the trees. It'll eventually dry up. But it's persistence again. One of the best tools for gardening, patience and persistence, I'm afraid.
Can I just add
one little suggestion
on that? Oriental bittersweet is a rampant invasive plant everywhere that it's used. It's also probably the most popular thing to make holiday wreaths out of.
Good point.
Now, if one of those berries from a wreath that you have on your door makes it to your soil, you're going to have a bittersweet vine that's going to take over everything in a very short time.
Wow,
so
I want to
encourage people is, if you have one of those wreaths and you bring it in for the holidays, after the holidays, put it and seal it in a trash bag so nothing gets out, and throw it out with the trash. Don't just put it on a compost or do anything, because I'm telling you, if any of those berries gets into your soil, you're going to have a big problem.
All right, we've talked about generational differences and things that millennials are interested in. Here's some kids even younger than millennials who were learning about gardening with the staff of the Washington Youth Garden on the grounds of the U.S. National Arboretum a few months ago.
These tomatoes weren't trellised so well, and that's fine. They did great. It's just a little bit harder to find the tomatoes. But these are
called. You can't pick the green ones?
Black cherries, and we want them to be this color.
Yeah,
green. Okay.
Oh, I see a lion.
We want them to be this color.
Yeah.
Okay.
Libby, how do you assess the interest of young people in Vermont in learning about gardening and becoming gardeners themselves?
So, in terms of just how interested, kind of the interest we see out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say in terms of the schools around Vermont, in particular, the young people, the age of those folks we just heard in that that clip. School gardens are in almost every school here in Vermont. In fact, one of our goals is to get more and more school gardens out there. And so kids are learning about it at a really young age and are...
You mean beginning in, say, elementary school?
Elementary school, and even earlier, early child care centers, that sort of thing, too. And really getting jazzed about it and teaching their parents about it. It's a way that that is getting more healthy food into their diets. They're asking their parents to grow certain things that they didn't want to eat, you know, 2 years before. And so starting at a very young age, we're seeing a lot of that and kids getting excited about it. And then coming right up through, you know, more young people wanting to become farmers. It's just definitely a trend that we're seeing here.
All right, let's go back to the phone. We've got Eric on the line from Detroit, Michigan. Eric, go right ahead.
Hey, John. I had a question. Because of the climate that I live in, the winters can be pretty harsh, and I was wondering, my wife and I really gotten into succulents lately, and I was wondering if there was any particular succulents that would be able to grow outside in such a harsh winter.
Melinda, that's kind of your neighborhood. What do you say?
It is. And actually, they're a little bit milder than Wisconsin. You're on the right side of the lake, Eric. There are some hardy succulents. Prickly pear cactus is native to 48 of the 50 states. So you might want to start with prickly pear cactus. Always having some you can bring in and out. There are some others that there's a hardy cacti and succulent organization. So I would do a search on the internet, and there's some good listings and also sources where you can purchase them. If you happen to get over to Wisconsin during the Wisconsin State Fair, the Hardy Cacti and Succulent Group has a wonderful garden on display as well. And so you might want to check that out. Or drop me a note and I'll give you a list of some of those plants and some resources as well.
All right, let's go to another call. We've got Charlotte on the line from Baltimore, Maryland. Charlotte, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. My question concerns trees. Recently, climatologists have said that we're now entering a cycle of weather where storms are lingering overhead for weeks at a time, or maybe even months. And this can go on for several years, apparently. And I understand, and this is my question, that trees will continue to absorb water. They just don't know when to stop drinking. And meanwhile, the soil is becoming so saturated that trees become very top-heavy and fall. We've had that happen in Baltimore quite a bit. Is that true? That trees keep absorbing water?
Steve?
And can fall?
Well, I mean, they would keep absorbing water over a period of time, but they don't absorb so much water that if the soil is saturated, the tree blows up or anything. I think the reason that you're having problems with trees falling is when the soil becomes saturated with water, the roots lose their grip on the earth. And that's the reason. So that's my answer to that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Emily on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Emily, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, John. I have spearheaded a school garden program at my children's school, and I tell you, it's a double benefit both to myself when I'm with the children in the garden. It's magical for me to see their awe. I can't get enough of it. I'm addicted to it. But also just the children, they tend to find a calm that those children that are prone to OCD, anxiety, the garden can calm them in a way very few other things can.
That's a fascinating point, Emily. Libby, do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the number of times I hear teachers say students that don't thrive in the classroom, that find their place in the garden, that become the compost or bug experts or whatever it happens to be, it's incredible. And it's really a place, too, where they can grow skills and become leaders in ways that they weren't able to be maybe in a more classroom environment. But, it's super exciting to see.
Now, Libby, I've got another question that comes from very close to home. I have a friend who is a participant in a community garden, and she asked the question, what do you do about people who steal from them?
That is a perennial question and a good question. So everyone has a little bit of a different take on that that concept of they call it garden pilfering, and I guess I would say two things. One is sort of why. You know, asking yourself the question, why are they stealing from you? Chances are, if they're stealing vegetables, that probably means that they need some vegetables, that they, you know, they need the food. The strategies I give a lot of our community gardens that come to me with that problem, one strategy is border gardens. So having in your community garden, you know, having nice signage that says, you know, people in this community garden work hard, grow, you know, that this food is for their families, the food inside is for them. But this food along the border, which could include berry bushes, could include cherry tomatoes, things that are easy to pick along the edges, can be for the community. And I've seen that be real successful in terms of really helping people understand, you know, those borders, and but also providing some of that food that's needed as well.
Is the principle, Libby, of a community garden that if you are growing vegetables, for example, that those are for you as opposed to other members of the community, not to mention people who are not part of the community garden?
Oh, it depends on the garden that you're in and what you're trying to pull off, too. So I would say typically, again, your prototypical community garden, the food from that your garden, your plot, is for you and your family. But I've seen lots of other models. In fact, a number of gardeners will grow a bunch of food for themselves but then grow a row that goes to their local food shelf or to a community kitchen, that sort of thing. I've seen lots of gardens that have a more communal kind of aspect of their certain crops that are grown for the entire community or that are kind of open to neighbors, that sort of thing.
Got it.
Let's
go back to the phones. We got Michael on the line from Edinburgh, Virginia. Michael, go right ahead.
Yes, I love your show. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for calling.
My question is, I had half of my garden that I wasn't going to use. I used my tractor. I tilled it up very nicely. And I wanted to plant landcress. I planted landcress there, and every single bit of it come up. But it only got a half inch tall, and then the weeds done took it over. And I don't know why it didn't overtake the weeds. And I planted one row of garlic, followed directions to the T, and only four of them come up. I'd like to know what to do.
Melinda, what is your advice to Michael and his problem with his landcress?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, it's about weeding out to try to give that landcress a chance to get the sunlight and the nutrients and the moisture it needs. One thing in the future, or for people doing late plantings that may have a bare spot, after tilling and preparing the soil, depending on how large your garden is, covering it with clear plastic to solarize. Now, to kill everything, you need 6 to 8 weeks in the hottest part of the season. But even just a couple of weeks to warm the soil, especially those of us in the north, we can jump start in the spring that way. But just killing those weed seeds near the surface really eliminates a lot of your weed problems, so that when you do plant your seeds, the soil's nice and warm, things will sprout. The weeds are going to be delayed a bit so that your plants get a head start on it. So weed control is really critical when once you're planting transplants, mulching, putting shredded leaves, pine straw, evergreen needles, whatever organic material to help suppress the weed seeds, but do that between where you've seeded your rows or put your transplants in. That too will help slow the weeds, conserve moisture, and as it breaks down, it improves the soil. And adding organic matter to our soil helps absorb the water. We've been talking a lot about too much water, but also helps hold the moisture. So those of you gardening in sandy soils, it'll help hold the moisture as well and increase the absorption ability.
Terrific. Let's get another caller. We've got Len on the line from Gordo, Alabama. Len, go right ahead.
Hi, John. Great show. This is more for Steve. Steve, I kind of feel your pain on the grumpy part because we grow hybrid daylilies. We grow about 500 varieties, and we get the question all the time about what about Stella Dior? And the question we get all the time about this lily I bought at the big box store. And these lilies, and why don't they bloom? And we carry our lilies to a market called Pepper Place in Birmingham. And we also grow and sell from home. It's really kind of a hobby that got out of control. But in your Southern Living article recently, or somebody, an article in Southern Living featured the oaks, and it featured some really pretty lilies, but not a one of them, except maybe Dorothy and Toto, were introduced more recently, say, than the early 2000s. And there's so much more quality and rebloom capability, higher bud counts, more ruffles and things in the newer lilies. And I would like to challenge you to maybe do an article with new lilies instead of some that are so old. We think the daylilies are perfect for any. It'll grow all over the place and it requires very little care.
Len, thanks for your call. Steve, what do you say?
I would just say that you have to remember the audience that I'm writing for. And the audience, at best, are weekend gardeners. They don't know all the horticultural names. They don't belong to plant societies. And they have to be able to
Len obtain. Sounded like a member of the gardening elite.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they're not hybridizers. They just want plants that are going to bloom for them. And they also have to be able to find these varieties, and most of them are not going to go online to find them. They're going to go to their garden centers. So, and they're also not going to pay $25 for a single plant. So, when I mention varieties, whether it be daylilies or anything else, I have to make sure that first, they're not too expensive for the average gardener, and they're not inaccessible for the average gardener. And unfortunately, a lot of the new introductions, whether it be daylilies or hostas or irises or something, people are paying $50 a plant for those. The average gardener's not going to do that.
Well, that's right. And I hope that we've made this hour on gardening accessible to the average gardener and not simply the gardening elite. I know, Melinda and Steve, you guys talk to the elite all day long, but this is a popular show right here.
Oh, I love talking to beginner gardeners. I feel like that's that way to get them into that movement and find the joy. And then they will look for those unusual varieties as they get more confident and find that it's easier than they think.
Melinda Myers, TV and radio host, columnist, author of more than 20 gardening books. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Libby Weiland, statewide network coordinator for the Vermont Community Garden Network. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, John.
And Steve Bender, the Grumpany Gardener. You weren't that grumpy. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you. I'll try better next time.
All right. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsosis, Allison Poley, Jeremy Rayosa, James Ross, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Caroline Anders. The executive producer of On Point is Karen Schiffman. I'm On Point. I'm not On Point. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.